Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And the program today is slightly different from what you're used to because we're really zooming in and focusing on two important chefs in Sydney, Australia. It's more in-depth than we usually do, but it was worth it. They were wonderful meals, probably holding up against it among the best meals we've had in years and years.
Absolutely. And it's interesting. There's a huge rivalry between Sydney and
Melbourne.
Sydney's slightly bigger population-wise and trendier and all that kind of stuff. The Sydneysiders say, and Melburnians say the opposite, of course. They say that people from Sydney are all just hicks. They don't know anything about anything. So it's wonderful that there's a thriving restaurant scene in both cities, and we spent most of our time in Melbourne, as you know, if you've been with us the last several weeks. But we couldn't leave Australia without spending a couple of days in Sydney, and we picked out two of the restaurants we thought would be the best.
Now, admit to it, the one we picked out only because you thought it was your name.
No. It was because it was a seafood restaurant, and we know the Sydneysiders love their seafood, and Australians in general love their seafood,
and there's
a good reason why they should, because it's plentiful and delicious and all that stuff. Let's start out with the restaurant that at first sight sounded kind of boring. The Bridge Room.
It sounds old-fashioned.
The Central Business District in Sydney, Australia. Doesn't sound like it's kind of a trendy, absolutely must-go dining kind of place, but it sure turned out that it was.
Oh, I loved it.
And Russ Lusted and his wife, Sonny, worked together on this restaurant. They both were in the restaurant business and then in the hospitality business, more in hotels. And then Russ finally decided it was time to go back to his first love, which was chefing. And we're so glad he did, because the food that he cooked for us, and some of which we're going to talk about in the interview, was just absolutely smashing.
Lusted. It's a Lusted.
Lusted.
Lusted. Which is a Scandinavian origin, I've learned. This is called the Bridge Room. Repeatedly, I read it was the best restaurant in Sydney. And I didn't know why, or even if I believed it, until I came here. And I have to say, this chef is totally brilliant. We had the most fabulous meal, Ross.
Well, thank you, and it's nice to have you here.
You are so multifaceted. Where to start? You've been a chef, a restaurateur, an artist, everything. Can you pinpoint a little bit about how you got where you are career-wise? Why? How?
I am South African by birth, and we moved to Australia. And my parents were insistent that I was going to be a dentist. And the only thing I kept from that was the white coat. But I think for me, being a family, an artistic family, my mother's a painter, my dad is an engineer, I think you're always surrounded by a creative family, and I wanted to always do something creatively. So for me, the first time I stepped into a kitchen, it was sort of controlled chaos. You know, you could get away with pretty much anything. You could stay out late at night. You could drink. There were, like, hot waitresses. There was all the things that, you know, you were interested in as a 15-year-old kid. So for me, restaurants and hotels have been my life sort of ever since then.
Now, you've been around the block and then some. Have you lived in how many different countries?
Seven different countries. And as a hotel developer, I stopped cooking in 2000. And then I worked for a company called Aman Resorts in hotel management and then in hotel development. So we moved, opening hotels, Singapore, Indonesia, Japan, Croatia, Montenegro, US, so all over. And then worked in a lot of other different countries as well. So for me, stopping I stopped cooking in 2000 and started again in 2011. And for me, the actual, I suppose the learning curve of not cooking is a really, for me, has been the most eye-opening and understanding what you really want to do.
See, that's the part of you I don't understand. I mean, you were, as I said, I understand why everybody raves about your restaurant once I was here and ate your food. And you, everything that you look for in the chef is here. I mean, everything's totally balanced. I couldn't believe it. And exciting. Why would you stop and why would you restart?
You know, I work for people like Neil Perry and David Thompson, and I think when you work for chefs like that, if you go and do your own thing, you're always going to be compared. And I also was a little bit, I suppose, frustrated with the industry. And in 2000, post-Olympics, we were opening big restaurants. It was all about numbers and volume. And, you know, Terence Conrad was doing what he was doing in the UK. And I just thought, what's this all about? We're losing the hospitality in the hospitality industry. And I really liked hotels. And I knew Adrian Zecca, the chairman of Aman Resorts. And I sort of reconnected with Adrian. And I thought, well, I have an interest in architecture and hospitality. So Adrian was doing some very different things in the hotel business, and I just joined as a hotel general manager, which I'd never done before, and my wife and I, we managed hotels for Adrian, and that for me is another whole facet about what makes my restaurant what it is today. And I think I felt as a chef I needed to travel more, to see more, to understand, to then formulate your own style. It's easy to cook, but to cook and be unique within a country where we have so many talented chefs and so many great restaurateurs, if you're going to operate here, you have to stand out and you have to find what you're about. And for me, that was 10 years of traveling and eating out, eating in restaurants and saying, why do I like this restaurant? Why does it feel good to me? Is it the comfortable chair? Is it the quality of the acoustics? Is it, you know, how the cutlery is? Is it the style of service? And I think then you build an idea of what you want your restaurant to be. And that's what I did.
Well, I'm going to ask you an impossible question. I mean, what is it about this restaurant? Now, I know what it is in terms of we've had exquisite service, wine service and wines. Your food is so, it's just beautiful. Whatever you're going to expect, it's going to be better. From your perspective, what do you feel is the most unique thing about your restaurant here? And did we say it's the Bridge Room? I think we did.
I think for me, the initial idea of the restaurant was to feel, I collect ceramics, I collect mid-century furniture, I collect art. So for me, this was just a real idea of that you were coming to dine in our house. And to have that approach, as if your guest's coming over for dinner, you know, would you make your guests wait at the door? No. Would you give them hospitality when they arrive? Of course you do. Do you cook the food that they would like to eat in an environment that feels comfortable? Those are all the things that I think any restaurateur, you do think about. And like I said, we were talking before, and I said, you know, I love this building. And this building, for me, was the start of that. We didn't want table linen. We wanted something that connected to the history of the building. So we put the felt placemats, because this building was built for the wool industry originally in the 1930s. I always loved it. I always loved the parquetry. I loved the windows, the glass, the light. So I think the story starts there. And then, you know what, I'm kind of a bit older now, and I don't really care in the nicest possible way. You know, there's food trends, and I just cook the food that I really like to eat. I find the produce that I really like. I really work closely and very hard at finding that produce. And then with a team of people, you can create something. You know, we cook on a Japanese grill, because being South African, and a lot of the countries I lived in, the one thing that was the continuous vein was cooking on charcoal. They do it in Indonesia, they do it in Japan, they do it in Croatia, South Africa. So when I came back, you know, we literally built the kitchen around the grill. So the grill weighs half a ton. It had to be craned in. And then we started building everything around that. And the menu is all driven around the grill. You know, you had the duck today with burnt bread. You know, that burnt bread sauce is a, you know, I wake up most mornings to the smell of burning toast in my house, you know. And I thought, well, if we burn bread, and what would that taste like? Because there's that nostalgic smell of toast and burning bread, which then is now translated into something that is very different but quite palatable. So
yeah, it's a huge trend in the US right now. Burnt toast.
Yeah, burnt toast. I mean, Yanni Christos always said to me, he came for dinner and he said, you know, I've always made bread sauce, but I never thought of burning the bread. And I said, well, you know, you need to have a wife that burns toast most mornings. Then that's where the inspiration is, you know.
You know, just to explain, I mean, it's very hard to explain why this is so wonderful. I mean, this is really at the top of our list in terms of restaurants in Australia. Can you just run through a couple of these dishes and explain what they are?
Well, the first course, when we opened the restaurant, we said we would never do a tasting menu. But with the success of the restaurant, a lot of people coming and really wanting to just enjoy the that dining experience with matching wine, and you know, Matthew Asamelli has been here almost from the day we opened, which is fine.
And he's very, very good. I mean, I said I'd like to take you home with me. You're so good. He said, I've heard that before.
Yeah, I bet he has. We really limit the wines here to 200 wines on the list, and I think that's a little bit to do with the logistics of the site that we have. But I also think there's too many restaurants that have what I call fat, lazy wine lists. They're just labels that are collected, and they have multiple vintages. And in a small restaurant where we change the menu constantly, you have to move with that. And a sommelier, you know, when you limit them to the amount of wines that they can have on their list, you really, if you want to put another wine on, you have to take something off. And is that wine good enough to warrant taking something off? And I think that it's like produce. I mean, in the kitchen, yes, I can buy so much produce, but what is the best at that time, and what are we serving? So the tasting menu that you had today, some dishes that have been on that people expect to sort of have when they come here, which actually at the moment is only one of the, or two of those dishes are on the tasting menu. But it really is what produce are we doing at the moment that is very true to the season, and those are the dishes that we currently serve on the tasting menu.
You're not pick a dish or two or three and describe it in detail, please, especially your signature, which was so delicious.
So I think, yeah, sure. You know, the Wagyu shoulder, which is about your third course, you know, you start with raw fish, and I always think the idea of building flavor into the dining experience, it should start very quietly, and then as you get further and further into the meal, you have some heavier dishes and also more flavor, because your palate is sort of started to get ready for those flavors. I suppose you don't want to get punched in the face the first dish you have. So you start with a really light raw fish dish. At the moment, the Emperado is amazing, white fish, smoked eggplant, which we grill, apple vinegar and puff rice. Then the crab meat, which we get from Fraser Island, is spanner crab meat. And that now, this time of year, is all about finger lime, citrus, coconut, betel leaves. So that's a dish that is, I suppose, comes from my time cooking Thai food. They're very strong flavors, and I like those flavors with the sort of subtlety of the crab meat. And then the Wagyu shoulder is a play on a dish. I went to a restaurant in Kyoto where they only serve Kobe beef, and there's no menu and there's no wine list, and they serve Kobe beef and first growth Bordeaux, and that's it. And one of the dishes I had there was a raw Wagyu shoulder, and there's one chef, there's only 12 seats, and he grilled these matsutake mushrooms and served the raw beef over the top. It just melted into the mushrooms. And I just thought, what a clever dish to take a secondary cut like that and serve it raw. And so when I opened the restaurant, it was one of the dishes that I thought, as a travel memory, it was something that I really wanted to recreate. And so that's been on the menu since we opened the restaurant. And then the fish dish you had after that was a coral trout. And I think coral trout is one of the most extraordinary fish we get in Australia. And this time of year particularly, it comes from the Great Barrier Reef region up in Cairns. And we just poach that in butter and serve it with a Chinese black vinegar sauce, which and age pancetta, because we age pancetta for 7 months. And that then gives you this sort of contrast of the pancetta really cuts the acidity in the vinegar, and the fish is very, very delicate. And the caterpillar mushrooms are another sort of textural element in that dish, which is it's a very simple dish, to be honest, but there's quite a bit of complexity in how it works. And then we get to the burnt bread, and the duck we grill over the ash of the, not the, once the fire has burned down, we keep the ash, and the ash is still very hot. So the fat drips into the ash, and it creates smoke, and then that sort of smokes and grills the duck. Duck is, I think, is not served that often in restaurants, and I find a lot of people don't cook duck at home, so it's something that they enjoy going out to dine. And we serve at this time of year figs. We steam the figs, they're pressed, and we serve it with a vinegar made out of the pressings of the figs and plums, flood plums. And then the bread is actually burnt on the grill, and then we make an aeration out of the pureed burnt bread. So I think that smokiness of the duck, and then there's this sort of creamy memory of conjures up those memories of burnt toast. And so I think there's a lot of play on what people perceive in the memories of dishes and why they like it, and they don't really know why, but when you eat when you have a barbecue as a kid, and you know those flavors are always, and they're always with me as growing up. And every time I tend to cook, the food I like the most is grilled food. So it's combining that into a dining experience where it's not just barbecue. So, and then the black sesame dessert, it's a funny story. I was asked by Valrhona Chocolate to create a dessert for their new white chocolate they were launching on the market. And I hate white chocolate. And so the two things I really detest are sesame, black sesame, and white chocolate. And because when I lived in Singapore, they used to make this drink, and it was like a hot water with sesame paste, and you'd have it instead of coffee. And I the two things that I just couldn't stand, that black sesame drink. And then when Valrhona asked me to make this dessert, it was white chocolate, and I thought, I don't like white chocolate. But the actual Opalus white chocolate that I'm converted, it's a fantastic product. But I thought the two things I dislike the most are white chocolate and black sesame. So I thought I'd combine them. And to Valrhona's disgust, I made a dessert out of their white chocolate that was black. So, but it's we've sort of had that on for quite a while now, and it had a lot of good press and dessert of the year and all that sort of stuff. So that is it's an unexpected dessert. The texture of it, I think, is very interesting. And with the Pilo de Sapa melons, the Spanish variety of melons, and the roasted sesame paste, I think it's an unexpected. And I don't have a pastry chef. I do the desserts myself.
Okay.
Yeah, I find pastry chefs, I struggle with their palate. I think a lot of them, their palate is very jaded by consuming so much sugar. And so they're all a bit wacky. So I tend to do the desserts myself, which I think there's also, in the context of a meal, there's texture, structure, balance of flavor, and I think if you don't do the desserts yourself, you end up taking a little bit of a detour, and it doesn't feel like you're in the same restaurant. So I've always, and I'm not a pastry chef, so it is a struggle to do it, but I think it does create the continuity that you need to have in a meal. And so it starts at the beginning and it should end the same way, not feeling like there's a different element coming in or different person's ideas coming in. So it is a challenge, but hopefully people like the desserts.
We promise we won't tell our friend Dominic Ancel.
that he is a rebel
in Sydney, because that wouldn't surprise me if one day you two guys don't work together and he opens one. I just wanted to close with one fascinating little story, because we came and sat down in this restaurant and your sommelier said, "You were here yesterday." I said, "I was not here yesterday." He said, "I thought I saw you outside yesterday." Because I was doing a reconnoiter, coming past the front door, and I wanted to make sure I was at number 44, and it was the right number 44, and I was puzzling over the fact that there were boxes of wine and boxes of food just inside the front door. So I guess I looked at that a couple more times, and then I was recognized. So when we came back for lunch today, there was nothing I could do. I couldn't say, no, I've never been here before. I'm so glad we have been here this time. Please give our regards to Sonny, who helped with all the arrangements to make all this happen, because it's been just a delight.
It's thank you, and thank you for coming. It's really interesting how you say that about our front door, because we only have one door into the restaurant. There is no back door. And so it's always a challenge. But having spent a lot of time in New York, you know, and my kitchen is the smallest. We have no walk-in chillers or cool rooms or anything like that. So we get deliveries twice a day. And it's always a funny thing. I mean, you know, the food, the chefs can never get ahead, and the food is always fresh, which is a good thing. But it is that challenge of never having, being able to just sneak out the back. So, and we have an open kitchen, so you can always tell when the chefs are actually doing their work. But it's been a pleasure having you here, and we hope we'll see you again.
Well, I mean, I would recommend this restaurant to absolutely anybody listening to this program. It was just really spectacular. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Boy, I wish I could go there again tomorrow and have Ross cook for me once again.
Yeah, me too.
It's a long way to go for dinner.
Yeah,
I can't wait to go back, but it was worth the journey. And after the break, you'll have another aspect of worth the journey when we talk to Josh Nyland from St. Peter. But let's just take a quick break, and then we'll be right back, so don't go away.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and everybody knows who the patron saint of fishing and fishermen is, right?
Well, I'm not sure, but it's, if you think about it, it's not too hard to figure out, I guess.
No.
I think some people would actually say St. Andrew, but in fact his brother St. Peter is the one, I guess, but...
My grandmother used to cook a fish called St. Peter's fish.
Yeah, there is a fish by that name as well. But the interesting thing, of course, is the reason we picked out this restaurant is because it's named after me.
Yes, of course.
No, I mean, everybody should understand.
This is exactly
why we pick out the restaurants that we go to. So we've been to lots and lots of restaurants called Anne over the years. But seriously, seafood is the name of the game in Australian cooking to a huge extent.
Especially in Sydney.
And especially in Sydney. And the wonderful part about it is there's such a great product that's available in Sydney, about the Sydney Fish Market, more during the interview itself, because we went there as we ordinarily do, and we were disappointed because it's in transition from being infamous to being famous, or from famous
to
being the Sydney Fish Market.
Oh, the fish market.
You remember how disappointed we were?
Oh, it was awful.
Because it was so incredibly crowded.
Awful.
And we talked a little bit with Josh about that. But Josh is a very interesting young man. Josh is the kind of life story that you hear on Ellen or a program like that, where this is not just your everyday young chef. This is someone who's had an awful lot of life experiences. And as a result of those life experiences and the people he had the opportunity to work with, he's learned a tremendous amount about how to deal with seafood in ways that...
He's an absolute expert.
That we never even would have thought about.
No.
So right. That's one of the reasons the interview is so long, is because it just kept on going with information that we knew you would find absolutely fascinating, things you would never have thought about before. And to cap it all off, you get a wonderful meal on your plate when it's over. And the only thing I was disappointed in was we didn't have an extra meal we could go there, so I could have his wonderful fish and chips.
You loved that.
We didn't have a meal time available to have them. we just had to eat what he put in front of us, which was wonderful. St. Peter in the trendy area of just outside the center city of Sydney called Paddington, which would certainly be a place that you go, even if you don't eat there. But Josh Nyland and his wife serve up a mean seafood meal at St. Peter, right on the main street, Oxford Street in Paddington. And
it's an adorable area, too.
And here's Josh to talk to us. And sit comfortably here, because this one takes a while.
Now, we came to this restaurant because it's named St. Peter, and Peter thought we absolutely should come to this restaurant. But in fact, we're not here because it's named St. Peter. We're here because Josh Nyland is one of the hottest chefs in Australia, and certainly in Sydney. And Josh, I've been looking forward, because you have, first of all, you have a very thoughtful approach to your food. I love your concept, which we'll talk about, the head to tail, or whatever we're going to call it, and you've been around. Let's start with going back to, you were born, you're like 28 years of age, so you're young.
Yeah, I mean, starting way back, I suppose, as a child, I grew up in a town called Maitland, which is in the Hunter Valley, in New South Wales. So it's, you know, it's God's country, I suppose. It was a nice place to grow up. It was quiet. You know, we had the beach in Newcastle that was about half an hour drive away, so there wasn't really too much. Yeah, right. Yeah, no. So fantastic water. Like, you know, Mum would take me fishing every now and again to the Hunter River. So you'd catch things like flathead and, you know, things like the occasional turtle would get on the line as well. So there was moments like that, but I suppose it was never like a big chefy focused food orientated upbringing like most chefs have. So yeah, I suppose growing up then, when I was 8 years old, I had a tumor. I had cancer as a child. So
really?
2 days after my 8th birthday, I was diagnosed with a tumor on my kidney. So then that stemmed off into a few years of, you know, rigorous treatment and, you know, rehabilitation, that kind of thing. So after all of that, I suppose there was time where there was treatment happening where I wasn't able to go to school so much. So, you know, I'd be at home watching cooking shows, I'd be reading magazines. So it was an interesting kind of pastime that I started doing. I'm not 100% sure why. Like, I wouldn't say there was some definitive moment where I just like, I'm going to be a chef. It was always just a progression, or got more and more interested in food, and then I started cooking for mum and dad. And the generosity side of things was like feeding people, basically feeding mum and dad and buying ingredients and turning it into something to feed. That I always get a kick out of that. And even now, feeding people in the restaurant, the whole reason for the restaurant having an open kitchen is so I can watch people eat. It's just a inbuilt enjoyment, like seeing people have a good night. So then after that, getting a job in a cafe washing dishes and, you know, running food and making coffee and interacting with people on a social level of, you know, they're coming to a cafe to have coffee and, you know, and getting involved with that hospitality. So then from there, I decided to leave school in year 10 when I was, I think I'd almost turned 16 when I decided to leave school, and that wasn't out of the reason that I didn't do well at school. It was purely out of the reason that I didn't want to do the next 2 years of my schooling looking forward to doing 2 days of cookery class at school. I thought, well, if I can achieve 5 or 6 days of cooking all the time and get stuck into my training, then I'd prefer to do that than all the other things in between. So it was a choice made, and mum and dad were very, you know, they respected that decision, and they thought, you know, I could do anything. I got good marks and all that, but I knew I wanted to do what I did, so I went. Good to have supporting parents and my sister, and so then I started cooking in Newcastle at a restaurant called the Brewery Restaurant. So there used to be a Queen's Wharf Brewery pub, which is still there, I think. It's like the big Newcastle pub where everybody...
Brett Graham
was actually trained by my first head chef at one point. So Elizabeth Box, her name was. So she's like, you know, the chef of Newcastle, and everybody kind of knows Lizzie. And so to get in her team and be trained by her and her husband Anthony was a real treat, I suppose. It was something unique for Newcastle. They'd broken away from the big pub that they were in and decided to open a smaller restaurant. It was on the waterfront. We got good produce. There was a lot of stuff that came from Sydney that we'd get our hands on, and so I suppose we were one of the elite restaurants in Newcastle at the time, and the standard was very high, and I got a lot out of it. You know, all the obvious first year stupid mistakes that you do, getting a big cut in my hand and putting the knife through my hand while cutting a block of butter, that kind of stupid stuff. And I suppose partway through the time working as a first year, Peter Doyle, who ended up, he's still one of my good friends and mentors from my time at Est, but he came to Newcastle to do an event for Cancer Foundation, like Red Kite Foundation, who gave me a sponsorship I suppose my experiences with cancer, and they wanted to sponsor me and get me my first box of knives and all that sort of stuff and help with uniforms. So Red Kite was fantastic, and Peter came down for that, and he did a lunch with our restaurant and his, and I was speaking at the event as well. So it's quite a unique story. Like, I was cooking at the event as an apprentice, and then I got called up to speak on stage. So I left the kitchen, and that's where Peter was, and I left the kitchen. I went and spoke about my experience. I had some video playing, and then all of a sudden, I look over, and Pete's kind of, you can see he's quite emotionally kind of touched by it, and so I went back into the kitchen, and kind of whacked me, and he said, why didn't you say something? I didn't know anything about it. And so the rapport then between Peter and I was, he wanted me to come to the restaurant and experience Est and see what it was like, and whenever you're in Sydney, give me a bell. So then the very next day, I said to my mother, I was like, okay, I'm going to go down and see Peter Doyle. He told me I should come and see him. So I went down on the train by myself, and I ate at Est. I arrived at like 5 to 12 in my best clothes, and you know, I think I was 17 16 still, and I went straight in there. The waiters treated me like I was, you know, just like gold, and they put me on the best table, and as they sat me, there was more people coming through the front door, and they looked immediately at me in the eye, and the one lady had pearls around her neck, and the gentleman had a gold scarf around his neck, and like they were very, you know, formal and well to do, and they, I suppose, were wondering why I was sitting in their seat. And then they wondered again once they'd been seated that Peter was coming out to my table to see me. And but he was shocked that I'd made the effort to come down within 14 hours of meeting him. He said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, you told me to come and eat." So, and then that experience at Esk, although I'd already been cooking professionally, I suppose, as an apprentice chef in Newcastle, that experience was, I suppose, the definitive kind of, there's people in the world executing food at such a high standard, and I really want to be a part of it. And it made Newcastle seem like, not small, small's not the word, but like, I suppose it expanded my thinking. Yeah, it expanded my thinking that there's greater opportunities and there's a bigger world, I suppose. So after the meal there, I said to Peter, "I really want to work for you." And I suppose it was at the time that Peter had just won Restaurant of the Year and all that stuff, and so they were full, and there was no more positions in the kitchen. So Luke Mangan then recently had opened Glass Brasserie, so I then went on and worked with him. So from Glass, then after 18 months at Glass and going through the sections there, then I got the opportunity to work for Peter, and that's where I was for a few years. So and I really enjoyed that, progressed through being an apprentice chef right through to being junior sous chef, and then went on and worked at Fishface, and there's more to come. So
well, it's quite a story.
There's another chef in there too, and we think it might be the same guy, but we're not sure, which is Greg Hodges, who was at this restaurant called Fishface. But before that, we think he was at the restaurant called Pier, and we have a famous photograph of Anne and Greg Hodges talking to each other. With many gestures.
Greg Doyle was the owner of Pier, and Stephen Hodges was his second. And Greg trained Stephen for many years, and I was very fortunate to work for Stephen. He's a very unique person who had the ability to train anybody how to handle fish. Like, anybody came through the door and invested their time in what Fishface was all about, then they would walk away with a skill set that by anybody. So I'm very fortunate to have worked in that kitchen and learnt what I learnt, because by no means could St. Peter exist without that training. There's a lot of chefs out there that can teach you a lot about fish, but nothing of the detail that Stephen goes into. There's still things that he's taught me that I've never heard repeated before, like in terms.
Yeah, like what? I mean, first of all, it's sort of like artists that start with watercolor, which is probably the most difficult medium, and fish is sort of like that, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, everywhere in the world cooks fish, but I suppose the handling of what he did and what Greg Doyle did at Pier, it always started with, you know, where it was from, basic principles of finding the right produce and the best produce, and then what happens to it then once it comes into the kitchen. Do you stick to the conventional methods that have always existed, that you scale a fish with a scaler? Do you then wash it under a tap to get the scales off? Then you gut the fish, and then you wash the gut out, and then you wipe it all down, and then you lay it down on the tray and put it in the fridge. And then maybe you get 2 to 3 days, 3 to 4 days out of that fish then before it really needs to move out the door. You've got to get rid of it, or you just need to ramp up the lemon juice on it before it starts to spoil. Yeah, so that's right. Like, I mean, Stephen defunct all of that with dry methods. So dry being the fish comes in, you scale it, you wipe it down with paper towel, you gut the fish, you wipe it down with paper towel, and then it's forever just wiping moisture off the fish and never applying any more to it. And then laying it down on a tray, and then at the end of the night turning the fish over so that the moist side that was on the tray then goes to the top, and then the slightly drier side goes to the bottom. And it was that constant rotation that we managed every day, so that you could extend a fish's life from 3 to 4 days up to 8 to 9 without any kind of detrimental qualities to the fish. Like, it's, you know, so that thinking then stemmed off into my thinking of St. Peter and what I was going to do. And I've had a fish cabinet designed in my walk-in cool room that's got static. It's a static environment. It's got copper coil all along the walls, so it's able to sit between 0 and 1 degrees, the fridge. So it mimics an esky, basically. It's mimicking ice, but without any direct contact with water. So you're providing the best possible, like, environment for a fish to prolong its excellent quality. So we bought a heap of fish yesterday, for example. It's Easter this week, we've got Good Friday, and it's just going to be crazy. So we've got all this fish in there, but I know, I'm confident that what I've bought is excellent, and I've got the conditions to house fish properly. So even if we don't move it in the time frame that I'm thinking we will, that fish will still be perfect by next Thursday. Like, it's really unique, just... And people treat it like it's this trend, like, that I'm trying to tell people, yeah, we've got this 20-day aged albacore and things like this that, you know, come off like, oh, what's this guy doing? He's just putting numbers against a fish and he's... It's for a reason. Like, I'm trying to work out the nuances in fish, because if we ask somebody, what does wild kingfish taste like to you? Do you have an answer that isn't like, well, it's sweet and flaky and... You know, you can't start going off into another... Like, you start talking about texture rather than what actually it tastes like. So we're trying to be able to explain fish's flavour better. So when we start to know what a fish tastes like, then we can pair it better with our vegetables or our garnishes that we do. So it always starts with the fish, with our cookery. Like, it always starts with what the fish tastes like, and then we work back from there. So the garnish is really heightening what we know about the fish rather than... starting with the vegetable and then putting it on a fish, and it doesn't have to be any particular fish. So that's what makes us different.
Well, you know, I was reading about how you were matching the vegetables to the fish and so forth, and I can understand that. I was a little curious when I read that you also did this with dessert. How does that work, matching dessert to fish?
The fish dessert thing was just a fascination that I had, that there's all these ways with fish that we've kind of come up with, from offal to using the eyes and bones and all this stuff. Like, there's so much potential. The only thing that I haven't nutted out yet is the gills or the gallbladder. So I think the gallbladder is off limits. You can't touch that because it's like battery acid and it's horrible, and, you know, you can't do anything with that. And then the gills are just, you know, it's not for a Western palate, I suppose, and and I'm always trying to make things that are texturally and flavor, like, they're texturally exciting and like either crispy or something that we're familiar with. Like, you can't go and take a fish's milt, like the sperm of a fish, and then poach it and make it heighten its soft qualities and its creaminess, because who in Australia is going to sit down and eat that and find pleasure in eating that? So
I don't know.
No, that's right. It's kind of like it's you know, it works in Japan and it works in, you know, Asian cultures, because that's what they're texturally, that's what they're kind of used to. But I suppose I'm trying to find Australian ways of getting people excited about what goes in the bin.
That you're touching on this another thing that you're famous for is in meat, it's called nose to tail, and I've been calling it head to tail in fish, but is there a name for this?
I think a few people have thrown around nose to scale. So, I mean, going back on the dessert question, I'm sorry for trailing off, it gets easy. We found a fish that was a cobia from far north Queensland, and so... Out of a 7-kilo fish, there's approximately 1.2 to 1.3 kilos of offal that comes out of the fish. So offal being gills, being, you know, the eyes, the fat, the liver, the roe, or the milt, and depending on what the fish is. But the fat in particular was kind of startling. There was about 500 to 600 grams of fat around the organs. And so my head chef, Alana, and I, we... pulled it all apart and we had a look at the fat, and then we put it into a saucepan and we rendered it like duck fat. So you end up with liquid cobia fat, which, you know, has a fish fragrance to it without being offensive, but you can taste it and definitively know that you're eating cobia. So we were doing an event for Massimo Bottura and the Oz Harvest. Yeah, so he came to promote the refertorium project that he's passionate about, and Oz Harvest, obviously something that I've kind of foundation that I've worked with as well, and all to minimise waste. So we did a dinner with a group of chefs around Sydney, all showing off what we could do with byproduct, with waste, and with lesser utilised things, things that would get overlooked in a kitchen. And one of those things that we came across was the fat from the fish. So we rendered it all out, and then we made a salted butter caramel out of the fish fat. So we removed a percentage of the butter and then replaced it with the fish fat. And then we paired it with a chocolate bar, basically like a soft chocolate custard, the cobia fat caramel, and then we put some of the wasted fish scales that we have in the restaurant. So we caramelized them in sugar. So, I mean, it's a bit of a head scratcher in terms of getting your head around it and if you're willing or brave enough to eat it. But I suppose all of those people at that dinner that ate it were very, surprised at the complexity of it.
Of innards, I've had various parts. The earliest one, so years ago, the Japanese and then the French started doing monkfish liver, which was very popular, and we liked that a lot. And then there was some kind of a sack. I can't remember what kind of sack it was, but that was okay, too. I'm not sure about scales. I mean, do scales have flavor?
I'd be lying if I said that you could definitively taste what scale fish you were eating. So it's purely a textural thing. And because there's vast quantities of scales that come off our fish, obviously we process everything here. So everything that we get through the door is head on, scales on, guts in. So we're on the front line of what we choose to use rather than, you know, obviously getting fillets. You're very limited to what you can achieve.
Yeah.
And also you're limited in terms of the length of time you can store fish for. So really fillets are the easy way of just taking what you need for the day, on the day. Whereas the whole fish methods, you know, there's a lot of pre-planning, and it's quite laborious for a 34-seat restaurant to invest in the amount of staff that you need to process that volume of fish. So in terms of the scales, texturally, they're delicious. Like, it's like having this new, it's very glassy and crisp, and it doesn't linger, it just goes away. They kind of dissolve and go away quite quickly. We boil them 3 times in water just to make sure they're clean, and they start to break down the density of them, because at times when you eat them they're very hard and kind of they cut your mouth if you don't treat them well enough or you don't pick the right scale. Because obviously barramundi scales, some of those scales get up to like dinner plate size, because
really?
they're big fish. So we choose fish like the whitings and the nanny guy, like the native snapper, and they're much finer scale. And so after boiling them 3 times, we dry them out, and then we deep fry them at a very high temperature, and they go really crisp. And we put that on top of things like slow-cooked pumpkins that we've cooked all day through the oven. We take a scoop of pumpkin and cover the top in fish scales. So texturally, it's really, you know, it's delicious. And it's another way to show off what a fish is all about. So,
well, I mean, I can't wait to taste some of those things. I'm going to ask you the obvious. Like, could you name some of your favorite fish? And why? And would you name preferred techniques?
I think some of the fish on the menu tonight, actually, you're actually a little bit spoiled. Some of the fish on tonight are my favorite fish. And I'd probably want to, I suppose, 3 of them. Starting with pink ling, like an extremely underutilized fish, and one that's got a bit of a bad rap over the years for sitting on, you know, supermarket shelf, like supermarket frozen shelves and defrosting over ice. And this one here, Batterfried Bermakui Pink Ling. So Pink Ling's coming out of the South Coast. There's a lot that comes out of New Zealand, but we're working with Nicholas Seafoods down at the Sydney Market, and they are aware of our philosophy, and I've worked with the guys down there for quite a while now. So they get their hands on all Australian fish for us. And this Pink Ling, it's got a cod texture to it. It's really firm, and there's quite a good amount of fat in it. I haven't found a better cookery method for it than putting it in batter and deep frying it, which sounds strange. Like, we've tried poaching it, cooking it on the skin, tried grilling it, and nothing achieves what you can do in batter. And it's so moist, it holds its shape really well, it doesn't weep moisture, and it's got an excellent flavor, and it's non-confrontational to like kids as well, and kind of the older generation, I suppose, wanting their flathead and chips, like fried flathead in batter. Like, Australia, that's the backbone of fish and chips in Australia. It's always the flathead. And I suppose that's why on the menu we wanted to have a fish and chips that we could rotate. We don't always commit to one fish. So, we'll always have it on for the price that we have. That'll always remain the same. sometimes you'll come in and you'll have dusky flathead, and then other days it might be an ocean perch, or it might be the pinkling or a mowong, something like that. So we try to mix it up and make sure that people are seeing a broad range of fish, in particular the underutilized fish, because at times the underutilized ones are the best. Because they've got a higher oil content, they're slightly firmer, they don't behave well with the skin on at times, so then oftentimes it's better to take the skin off just to avoid curling and that sort of stuff. Yeah, I suppose the other one on the menu as well is the wild kingfish. Wild kingfish is one of those fish where everybody kind of resorts to the farmed kingfish that's got a much higher fat content, and it's more consistent, obviously, and it's often used a lot for raw methods rather than cooked methods, because a lot of chefs find it quite tricky to keep it undercooked, but as well knowing the fine line that once it tips over that point, then it just dries out and goes really chalky and dries out.
Borlotti beans from Italy?
We've got bologna beans from a local grower, and they're paired up with the kingfish tonight, so it's a nice change of the season now, getting into autumn quite well and truly. The weather's cooling off a lot now, so we've just tried to adjust things. Like, we've got things like artichokes and chestnuts and pine mushrooms, and the last season's Meyer lemons that we salted, and they're on tonight as well. So there's a really good mix of, yeah. So the kingfish is a really favourite of mine, and I always believe that cooking the fish on the skin in clarified butter just to get really crisp skin. And the methods that we're doing in the cool room, where we hang our fish on butcher's hooks to so that was another thing that we do, like where chefs have trained me to lay fish down on a tray, you're always going to get a moist side. Like, fish will always naturally sweat if it's sitting on itself, and hence why then you would need to turn the fish over at the end of the night. But by then putting it on a hook in a static environment, you've got air passing around it. It's never coming in contact with any moisture. So then I'm achieving another few days on top of what I already knew. So, you know, one of the best results I've ever had was hanging a Spanish mackerel for 18 days. And then at that point, then the mackerel's gone from this really clean, bright, ocean-driven, flavoured fish when on day one, which I'm not discounting as being not excellent. Like, if I could give people day one Spanish mackerel that's been brain-spiked and line caught, and then I'd do that every day of the week. But then we extended the shelf life of that, and we wanted to see day by day what happened, what changed. And so then when we did climb up above 15 days, then it really started becoming more complex in terms of tasting quite savoury, and had button mushroom notes and savoury and yeast. And so it was quite unique. And then that made us adjust our garnish to go with the fish. We started pairing it more with a whole salt crust roasted cabbage that we put with kombu yogurt. So something very different, like less bright, fresh, clean flavours that you would normally pair with fish, and then going the other way and treating it like a piece of meat. So those sorts of things are what excite me the most, and I suppose excite the kitchen the most. And the other fish that we've got on tonight is the Spencer Gulf herring. Now, herring's one of those ones that you either put under a lid and you pickle for pickled herrings, and or you salt them down and preserve my lemon. So I mean, all we do with the herring, it's quite tedious. We take all the bones out of the herring, which there's a lot, and we gut them, we butterfly them, we take the bones out, we leave the head on, we leave the tail on, and then we cook it on our small Japanese barbecue, like a little bichiten, and so you get this wonderful smoky herring that's had a lot of love invested into it in terms of the processing, and they're just set in the middle of the plate, and then a little salad of herbs and Meyer lemon, and then some garlic mayonnaise, so an aioli, and then a wedge of lemon. And I mean, that's probably a good representation of how simple we get with some of the fish. It's not always about pairing things up with a great level of complexity. It's also to show off a lot of restraint. So ultimately, we're feeding the people of Paddington, like we're feeding locals in Sydney. And the first fish to always sell out are the ones that are like crumb King George whiting with mayonnaise and lemon, or, you know, grilled calamari with, you know, a bit of dressing and some leaves. Like, they're always the dishes that move the fastest. So we're very conscious and aware that we need to feed loyal locals that are coming back a couple of nights a week, but as well we want to flex, I suppose, a bit and show the world that we're unique and we're doing something very different with fish to what's always ever happened.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm looking at the menu, and this is, listeners, if somebody says this is a fish restaurant, believe me, this is like the very, very teeny tiniest tip of the iceberg, because this is a very thoughtful menu, and the flavors represented on this are really amazing, I think. You mentioned something about the Nicholas. Do you source all your fish through? I just wanted your opinion on this. When we were ever in Sydney, we would go at least one day to the fish market and get a couple dozen of oysters, a bottle of wine, and sit out and just have a really relaxed, nice lunch. This trip, we went, and the tourist buses were like, you know, 18 buses deep, and the prices, and people shelling out $7 Australian, $7.50 Australian for a single Pacific oyster. We were so turned off, we turned around and went to a nearby bistro off the thing. What's going on? You still shop there, but I guess chefs go at a different level.
$7.50 for a Pacific oyster.
One.
Goodness. Yeah, I mean, I suppose the fish market's going through a little bit of a stage at the moment where they're gearing up for their new premises. Like they've been granted their wish of you know, freshening up, I suppose. So that's all in the works at the moment. I know that the tourists keep flocking down there. Like it's a definite hotspot that's the first go-to place for a lot of tourists. Yeah, hordes of people, and I suppose we're trying to tap into a little bit of that with the restaurant here. But Nicholas Seafoods is a fish company that I've used for the last 6 or 7 years. Yeah, and Tony Weir, my good friend Tony, he texts me every morning. He goes to the auction floor, and he texts me what's happening at the markets. I'll bring it up now on my phone so you can have a little look. But he makes me aware of what's on the floor. He tells me where the fish is coming from. He gives me a price as a fillet, a price as a whole. And he sends that out to all his chefs that he looks after. And then after that, the correspondence that follows between him and I is, will you tell me what I'm buying? So it's never to ask Tony, I need some ocean trout and I need some snapper. Right. It's always just, Tony, half my fridge is empty. Can you bring me up to full? And so then that's how we work. And it's a really great way to work, because I suppose if you're talking about inspirations and things of creativity and how dishes evolve and become like on the menu, it's purely based around this text message. Like that's the inspiration. Like I'll wake up in the morning, or my children will wake me up in the morning, and you know, it's always the message is there waiting, and it's always first thing. And, you know, you really get excited. Like, yesterday was a really exciting day. We got Striped Trumpeter from Flinders Island, which is getting line caught. And everybody knows Striped Trumpeter. It's the Rolls-Royce of fish in Australia. And we got Spanner Crabs out of Ballina, which is beautiful because I know they've been having a hard time up there with the cyclones and stuff at the moment. So it was fantastic to see that had come back. And, you know, the herring out of the Spencer Gulf. There's just all, like, it's exciting. And you start thinking of methods. You know, we start texting between the chefs in the morning. And so it's a really, like, it's a pleasurable thing. Obviously, then you have to achieve what you've bought then. Like, there's all the exciting things of buying all this great fish. But then the labor that follows is quite tedious. But yeah, it's Nicholas have really looked after us since opening. They've flown the flag for us really well. They, you know, use their social media to push out what we're doing, and as I do the same, I'm always very you know, quick to put Tony into a photo that I put up and say, well, Tony did his due diligence and found me the best, and so now I'm doing my best, and this is what St. Peter ends up being. So.
Now, you mentioned that you feed the people of Paddington, which itself is a rather fascinating and sort of trendy neighbourhood in Sydney that people should come to if they think about it, if they can
It's taken Mesh to get here, especially on Saturday and Sunday for the market. That's a whole lot of fun, too. But people have discovered you because you've been talking about Massimo Bottura and some of these other stars of the kitchen. How did they find you, or did you find them?
Good question. I suppose starting so young, starting 15, 16, and now I'm 28, I've been cooking a while, and I've been working really hard since when I very first started, and I've been making sure I've put myself into the right position at every possible moment, like every chance that I had to be in a moment that would help me eventually, I would make sure that I've said yes. There's very few moments in my career so far where I've said no, and I'm only learning now to say no, and that's out of, you know, responsibilities that I now have as a 28-year-old that has a business and a family. And even then, it's still very difficult because I do want to make sure that those guys know who I am. Whether that's important or not, it's important for me. I want to make sure that St. Peter is a success because it's my life. It's what pays the bills and what, you know, will help my kids go to school and all of that stuff. So in terms of these guys, whether they found me or I found them, I have been fortunate to work with excellent chefs that have helped me help propel my career forward by me doing whatever it takes to you know, get there. So working for Peter, I would put my hand up and do events outside of Est with him. And that would then mean maybe Peter Gilmore was there or Neil Perry was there. And so then through that, then that little circle would start. And then, you know, working for Luke Mangan, I would go to the Today Show at Channel 9 every Tuesday for a year and prepare his mise en place for TV. And so that circle would happen, and I would watch how he interacted with TV personalities and how he carried himself and what he dressed and how he spoke. And so that was a unique skill set and tool that I managed to take away from there. So I was always watching whatever chef I was working for. I was always watching how they conducted themselves as a person, just because all of that helps. Because if they can make it, then so can I. So, yeah, that's kind of it. I've just made sure I've been in the right place at the right time and just worked really hard.
Well, you're a remarkable young man, and we're not eating until later. I can tell it's going to be an amazing dining experience, and fish is my favorite thing in the whole world anyhow. So, listeners, if you manage to get to Sydney, Australia, check out, absolutely, Josh Nyland, who has St. Peter's. And it's just, I can't even wait to taste the food.
I can say one last thing, because I'm a substantial part of the reason we're here. Because it just happens to be my name, I just had to follow that wherever it went. a last thought, Josh.
I'm very flattered that you both have come and found me. That's another thing, you found me. I'm really excited to cook for you both. It's a fantastic day. I suppose we've got wonderful things on the menu, and it gives us a true representation of what St. Peter really is and what we're trying to do. Yeah, I suppose all we're trying to do is just, you know, cook the best fish that we can and get our hands on the best quality produce in Australia and make sure that people walk away from St. Peter knowing a little bit more about where they are. I suppose the whole philosophy of terroir cooking, of, you know, Rene did and what Magnus does and what all these guys all over the world, Dan Barber and all these, you know, great chefs, they've got amazing skill sets that they can transform food into something truly beautiful and, you know, very detailed. And I suppose I feel humbled that people are saying nice things about me and the restaurant and our team. It's challenging at times to listen to, because ultimately we're cooking a piece of fish and doing it with some vegetable. Like, it's really not overly complex, but I suppose the details are in the generosity and the logic of what we're trying to do. The main thing is just keep it really simple and restrain ourselves as much as we can from following what others are doing and just make sure it's very clean cut and people walk away understanding what they've just eaten, and hope that then in a couple of days' time they still think about what they had. So yeah, thank you for having a chat.
So anyway, we hope you agree with us and that this was a story that was interesting, worthwhile, all those kind of good things. And not only that, but we also learned something.
We learned a lot.
Learned a lot about how to treat seafood and a lot about how to prepare it and a lot about how you can triumph over difficult circumstances if you have the right attitude. This is just such a delightful young man. And his wife is charming, and we wish him every success. And you should all go there. It's that simple. And Anne just reminded me it's time to say we'll see you same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.